The History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program,
Berlin and Schöpel, Radio Nogarmona Eglair.
Nazi radio broadcasts to Ireland during World War II, Ask Gaeilge. Also,
you had to repent because you committed such an awful sin of having a baby out of wedlock.
Adoption files of babies given up long ago by unmarried women. And has the state's project to revive Irish been a success or a failure? And there'll be more too. So, what do you think of the state's efforts to restore our native language? James Keating took to the streets this week to canvass some views.
I'm from a Gaeltacht and I think that we should make a decision to just start using Irish alone. They did it in the Faroe Islands and within 10 years everybody was fluent.
It's very bad because I can't remember any of it, but I wouldn't have a solution to it either.
But I think it is promoted well. You know, I know a lot of children that go to the Gaelscoils now, even down the country and everywhere. So, and it's quite good.
Not the best, because there's not enough Irish schools, maybe. Could be promoted better.
No, it's not promoted enough, but I have started in the last number of years watching TG Cahar, and that has helped me a little bit as regards the oral Irish.
From what I remember when I was in school, I didn't think it was taught very well. And I don't know how well, like, street signs and stuff would really work at promoting a language.
In school, like, teachers try to promote it, but no one really wants to do it, I find.
I think there was a great push for it around 10 years ago when TG Cahar kind of kicked in, but then I think it's been a bit of a drop, so it's very difficult. I think it could be pushed a bit more.
We'll be coming to this a little later, so text 51551 or email history@rte.ie with your views, and we'll include them in the discussion. But first, we're going to talk about a very different dimension of the Irish language, Nazi broadcasts to Ireland during World War II, Ask Gaeilge.
Is moan sauce of them laut erinair le machorda erinacha, them howlu fein sitikush natine, agus bala namona in prawn.
From small beginnings, which featured a weekly talk in Irish, the broadcasts from Berlin grew into a nightly bilingual service in Irish and English. Joseph Goebbels, who was Minister for Propaganda in Nazi Germany, was the man behind this project. I'm joined by historian David O'Donoghue, whose research took him to Germany and Britain, and it all appears in a new book entitled Hitler's Irish Voices, the story of German radio's wartime Irish service. David, what was the idea behind these broadcasts? They started in 1939, and who was actually running the show?
Well, Miles, the idea really was a ploy on behalf of the German propaganda ministry to project the voice of Nazi Germany into Irish homesteads and Irish living rooms. And really, the not so well hidden message was that, you know, you've nothing to fear from us. They had all sorts of propaganda they were putting out, and they were denying, for instance, British propaganda, which was claiming the Nazis were persecuting Catholics in Poland and Czechoslovakia. And the Nazis were saying to us, we're not doing that. We're just like you. We're friends of yours. We respect your country and we even speak your language. The person who kicked off the broadcasts in December 1939 was Ludwig Mulhausen. He was a brilliant linguist. I mean, he spoke about half a dozen languages. He'd worked as a spy for Germany in southern Belgium, in Wallonia, in the First World War, and then he became a leading academic linguist in Germany. In the late 1920s, he was over here studying Irish on the Blasket Islands. He came back in the mid-30s to study Connemara Irish. And in 1937, he spent 6 weeks in the small fishing village, picturesque fishing village of Teelan in Donegal, and just beyond Killybegs there. And he was determined and succeeded in learning the Donegal Gaeltacht Irish.
So probably spoke better Irish than most Irish people did.
I would imagine so. I mean, I don't know how he managed to master it, but he did. And then there's come the outbreak of war and he was blasting out Nazi propaganda Ask Gaeilge.
But the name that I tend to associate with the Irish service, not so much the Irish language service, but the Irish radio service in Berlin, was somebody who had quite a pedigree, even more so than Mulhausen, in Ireland, in Dublin. Oh, Adolf Marr,
yeah, the director of the National Museum here in Dublin in the 1930s. He was an Austrian Nazi and a qualified archaeologist. He did a lot, to be fair to him. I mean, leaving aside, if we can, for one second, his questionable, political beliefs. He did a lot to build up the collection in the National Museum, which exists to this day. I mean, he bought artifacts all around the country. But there was this nasty side of Marr, the darker side of Adolf Marr, if you like, which brought him into the depths of Nazism. He was a committed Nazi. He joined the party in 1933.
While he was living in Ireland.
Yeah, living in Ireland up near the Burlington Hotel, where it is now. It wasn't there now. And his kids were born and reared in Ireland. In fact, they're elderly now. They live in their 80s. They're living in Germany. And they speak English with Dublin accents, very heavy Dublin accents.
I mean, Pat Wallace, we did a series called Speaking Out of the Dead a number of years back. And Pat Wallace, then the director of the National Museum, obviously totally disapproving of his Nazism, but saying that he was an excellent, really, really excellent director of the National Museum.
Just to be clear on one thing, Marr never broadcast to Ireland.
Oh, sorry.
He was behind the scenes.
Yes.
He was a key figure. Mm. He left here in the summer of 1939, went over to Berlin. When the war broke out, he got a top job in the Foreign Office on the Irish desk. And he was the guy really who inaugurated the nightly broadcasts for Ireland. Mm. That was in 1941.
Well, they were called Irland Redaktion. And at Marr's insistence, they were regular segments such as this.
As usual, we are beginning our programme this evening with a flashback into the history of British terrorism in Ireland. Exactly 21 years ago today, that is to say on Thursday, December the 17th, 1920, the British were prepared to stoop to the lowest form of murder and brutal intimidation.
And the unsurprisingly rather, it provided a platform for anti-Semitism as well.
These two terrible evils, Judaism and Bolshevism, are so real that I must bring home to you, my fellow Irishmen, the great danger to our country, to our holy faith.
And so it went on. What sort of other stuff did they broadcast?
Well, they broadcast traditional Irish music. They had Cant John McCormack. They only had about six or seven old 78 records, actually, to work from. So they had Cant John McCormack's Come Back to Erin. They had The Hills of Donegal. They had stuff like that, traditional stuff,
yeah.
You know.
Okay. And I mean, how many radio sets would there have been in Ireland in the 1940s? How many people would have been able to pick up this broadcast if they chose to do so?
Well, per capita, there weren't that many, because we're talking about the 1930s, you know, and times were hard. People couldn't afford to buy radio sets. Still less could they afford to buy the batteries needed to run them. But basically, there were 183,000 licensed sets in the country in 1941. Now, there would have been unlicensed sets as well. So you're talking about 200,000 radio
so
sets.
They had problems with licenses even in those days.
Oh, yes. In those days, yes. And it's not a new phenomenon.
And is it true that they broadcast coded messages, that the Irland Redaktion broadcast coded messages for German sympathisers in this country?
Well, that's absolutely correct. That only started in 1942, mind you. It was on air from December 1939. And then what happened was, when America was attacked at Pearl Harbor in December 1941, U.S. troops arrived in the north of Ireland en masse in January, actually the 26th of January, I think it was, 1942. And subsequently, only 2 days after, Hans Hartmann, who was Professor Ludwig Mulhausen's protege, if you like, the guy who had worked with him in the Celtic department at Berlin University before the war, Hartmann started quoting extracts from Wolfetone's diaries in Irish. And the same extracts were read in English by Jack O'Reilly, who was...
Somebody had translated the Wolfetone diaries, because the Wolfetone's diaries were written in English.
Yeah, yeah, that's correct, yeah, yeah. But they were translated in the 1930s by Porrigo Shukru, the Tralee poet and writer.
So it wasn't the Nazis themselves who had actually translated
it. No, not
that
at all. But we know for a fact from G2 files, you know, Irish military intelligence files, that coded messages were sent 2 days after the arrival of American troops in Ulster. So I think it's a pretty fair conclusion to draw from this that the Germans were trying to reach IRA units to amass information on the movement of US troops in the north.
And how were the coded messages transmitted?
Well, we don't know that, because all we know is that G2 were informed in late 42 that a cipher or code had been found in the Wolfetone diaries here in Dublin. But we don't think that the code was ever broken.
Mm. Now, did Germans realise that Irish was not universally spoken in this country in the 1930s and 1940s?
I think they were well aware of that. I mean, they would have known, for instance, from the published figures that, you know, one in every nine people in Dublin had a radio set. But when you got down to Kerry, it was only one in every 32 people had a radio set. So they were on a hiding to nothing broadcasting in Irish. They were not going to get a big audience. And this is why they started broadcasting in English in late 1941, because they realised that the audience was very small. Although Adolf Meyer was keen on targeting what he called this sort of intellectual elements in Dublin who did speak Irish and would have worked, you know, in government departments and stuff like that. In any case, the government here, De Valera's government, were fully aware of what was coming out of Berlin, because every night the broadcasts were on air. There was a team of shorthand typists taking down every word from Berlin, and this was typed up the following morning and up at McKee Barracks, the army headquarters, and the transcripts were given to the cabinet ministers in Dublin, so they knew what was going on.
And they couldn't do anything about it anyway.
No, they couldn't. Mm. But they did, actually, it's interesting you say that, because there were two episodes during the war when the government did take offence here in Dublin to what Berlin was saying. Normally they were able to ignore what was happening. But there were two episodes involving Francis Stewart, you know, the writer who died 14 years ago and is buried in County Clare. He was married three times, incidentally. But it's interesting that the first thing Stewart upset the Dublin government saying was in December 1942, he praised the IRA's northern commander, Hugh McAteer, and that sparked a diplomatic note to Berlin. And the second time was in the run-up to the June 1943 general election here, when Stewart started advising listeners not to vote for Fine Gael, but to vote for extreme Republican candidates. There were a certain number of independent mm-hmm. Republican candidates, and that sparked a diplomatic protest to Berlin.
Let's hear a little bit of Stewart himself. He had arrived in Germany 2 years earlier to lecture at Berlin University. He started broadcasting from Berlin in 1942, and his weekly talk Through Irish Eyes continued until January 1944, when he was sacked for refusing to broadcast anti-communist propaganda, as we hear now from the writer himself.
They began to suggest to me that the Bolsheviks, as they called them, the Bolshevik atheists and so on, must be extremely unpopular in Ireland, Catholic Ireland, and wouldn't be good if I cashed in on this and began talking about the Russian atrocities and their atheistical worldview and so on, which I immediately refused, because of all the countries waging war, the only one who was waging what you might call really an honourable war were the Russians. I refused to make anti-Russian or anti-Bolshevik propaganda, and my broadcasts were terminated. And I didn't get actually into a camp, but I was threatened with all sorts, and certain facilities I had had were withdrawn from me. That was the end of my broadcasts.
And Éireann Redacteáin broadcast to Ireland from 1939 until the end of the war in 1945. And Hans Hartmann's final broadcast consisted of a news bulletin in Irish on the 2nd of May, just days after Hitler's suicide. And to finish it all off, one last song from this station favourite. Given that they had 6 78s and they were on the air for 6 years, I'm surprised that it sounded as good as that on the last broadcast, John McCormick, and come back to air. And finally, what happened to the main protagonists after the war?
Well, the irony about McCormick was he was entertaining Allied troops during the war, you see, but the Nazis would have us believe that he was singing for them. But actually, Adolf Meyer and Mühlhausen, the two protagonists, they ended up in British internment camps where they were pretty badly beaten, and they died prematurely, Meyer in 1951, Mühlhausen in 1956. Hartmann went on and on, reinvented himself after the war as a Gaelic professor, and he was professor of Irish in the University of Hamburg. He died in the year 2000, as did Francis Stewart, who, of course, was a well-known writer and a member of Éisteána here.
David, thank you very much indeed for that. David O'Donoghue there, and David's book, Hitler's Irish Voices, the story of German radio's wartime Irish service, is published this week by Somerville Press. And David has also put together a documentary featuring the voices that we've heard during this item and many more besides. And you can download that exclusively on our website, where you'll also find photos of some of the characters involved. That's rte.ie/radio1/historyshow.